PRI's podcasts and on-demand audio are free, thanks to contributions from listeners like you. Make a difference. Invest in better media. Contribute at PRI.org. Thank you.
Hi, Patrick here. It's pod time. Assyrians, rejoice! The new dictionary is finally out after nearly 100 years. Also, beloved Japanese scholar Donald Keane, growing up in the 1930s, he hated learning Latin, but he loved the mystery of Japanese. Then came Pearl Harbor.
When the war began, I heard a radio broadcast saying there were only 50 people in the United States who could read Japanese. This was completely untrue. There were hundreds of thousands of Japanese Americans, but I didn't know about them. And I thought, maybe I'm one of the 50.
So he joined the U.S. Navy and ended up interrogating captured Japanese troops. Also today, the meaning and nuance of the word Canuck.
As a free man, I take pride in the word Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
I'm here with Patrick, and it's time to talk words. Rawr. New words, old words, censoring everything.
This pod, The World in Words, and The Big Show, the World Radio program, they're both co-productions of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH radio station here in Boston. Online, we're at theworld.org. The pod is at theworld.org/language. My blog posts are also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox. And there's a World in Words Facebook page. Today, the Assyrian Dictionary. That's followed by banned social networking words in France. Then a conversation with Japanese scholar Donald Keane. He's retiring from Columbia University and moving back to Japan. And finally, Canuck. Everything you always wanted to know about that word. Okay, first up, the dictionary that was nearly a century in the making. Scholars at the University of Chicago and elsewhere have been working on a 21-volume dictionary of the language of ancient Mesopotamia and its Babylonian and Assyrian dialects. And now it's finished, and people are very excited. Among them is Irving Finkel. He's from the British Museum's Middle East Department. He worked on the project and explained to the BBC's Robin Bresnahan why this is such a big deal.
Well, this dictionary was started in 1921, and it's just come to an end. And there's one big blue book. Look, I brought one to show you. They're about a foot tall, smart, dark blue books, one for each letter of the Semitic alphabet. And it's taken all that time since 1921. And the whole finished dictionary is too much for one person to carry in their hands at once.
So you haven't brought it all in with you.
I haven't brought it all. But I tell you why it's so important.
Yes.
Because this writing system, the cuneiform writing system, is the oldest writing system in the world. It's the first time that man fought to find a way to record thoughts in a written form. And we have 3,000 years of literature and language and records and stories from these people, the Sumerians, the Babylonians, the Assyrians. We have mountains of clay tablets with these inscriptions on. And in 1921, long after the languages were first deciphered, it was realised that what we had to have was a modern dictionary of this language, produced like the Oxford English Dictionary in Oxford, about the English language. So all the lexical information, all the passages that showed the nuances of how the words changed over the period. So what we have for each letter of the Assyrian tongue is one heavy volume with all the words collected. And it is a miraculous thing, because in 1850, when they first started to excavate in Iraq, they found lots of inscriptions in the ground and on palace walls and so forth, but no one could read a word of it because it was extinct. And a group of very brilliant scholars, people like Champollion, who worked on Egyptian, they all fought together and they kind of raced to try and decipher this ancient cuneiform writing. And before long, they broke it open and they realized that they were dealing with a Sumerian language and the Babylonian language.
So for those people who aren't a real kind of specialist in this, can you just open up the book for us and turn to a page? Give us an example of what you might find in there.
Okay, well, this volume is for the letter U. And under U, we have the word upnu, which means hollow of the hand or handful or fist. And it talks about poetry where the hands of the gods are described. It talks about prayer gestures. It talks about measurements. It gives, in careful columns of controlled text, all the evidence which shows the real meanings of these ancient words. So the thing is that if you ever see one of these bits of clay, and they look a bit like dog biscuits, they're made of strange material, they have strange markings on, but when you can read the script and when you have the language under control from a dictionary like this, we can read the ancient words of poets and philosophers and magicians and astronomers as if they were writing to us in English. And this is a wonderful thing. And this tool, which has now been finished, is really something for us to be proud of.
Irving Finkel of the British Museum, talking with the BBC's Robin Bresnahan. Now, if you listen to the pod with any frequency, you're probably completely sick of hearing me mention Facebook and Twitter. It's kind of a pain to keep saying it. I'm sure it's a pain to keep listening to it. You may have heard that my equivalent in France, who would that be now? Patrice Le Podcaster. Well, he can't mention Facebook or Twitter. Lucky him. At least if he's on French radio or TV. Maybe he can in podcasts. I don't know. But on the radio and on TV, those two words, they're banned. And here's why. French law states that you can't mention commercial brands. And that law has now been interpreted by the French equivalent of the FCC to mean that saying, for example, find us on Facebook, that constitutes covert advertising. Well, the Big Show's Marco Werman talked about this with political journalist Anne-Elisabeth Moutet.
Anne-Elisabeth, first tell us what French broadcasters can and cannot do now when it comes to encouraging their audiences to go to their social media sites. This ruling seems to change a lot.
Right now, they are supposed to tell you that you can follow, for instance, their own feed on the social media. You're not supposed to actually say that it's Twitter.
So just social media generically, they can't say
generically,
go to Twitter. Yeah.
Because otherwise it would be concealed advertising, which is illegal.
So concealed advertising, elaborate that a bit more, because I think most Americans would be somewhat baffled by this rule in France. I mean, what is the rationale for forbidding a direct mention of Facebook or Twitter if they're legitimate kind of news sources?
The idea is that if you advertise for something and there hasn't been a contract, there could be a conflict of interest, there could be hidden financing, there could be people on air being paid for it. And it's a kind of defiance on anything that is not strictly regulated. And also because the French public broadcaster, France broadcasters are now public and private, but it originated with a single public broadcaster. And there was no advertising on this for many years. And there still is a sort of Catholic attitude against all iterations of money, I should say.
The ruling seems a little out of step with what's been going on Twitter, considering how much stuff has been going on around the world where the news has started on Twitter.
Oh, it's ridiculous. I mean, there's no doubt about that. There's a feeling in France that because both Twitter and Facebook are American networks originally, this offends many people in France because you've got something even stronger in the French official psyche, and that's a tinge of anti-Americanism. You remember the bill that forbade the use of English words in the French language, especially in advertising, but in other ways. And the high authority says, no, that has nothing to do with it. We're just applying the law. But the truth is somewhere between those. Also, it is a bunch of old men and women, and they don't know much about Facebook and Twitter.
Okay, so for the young bloggers in France who see Twitter as, you know, this legitimate form of free expression, what's their reaction been?
Oh, they find this completely ridiculous. And there's a wonderful buzz on Twitter in French and in English. It's going to be interesting to see whether somebody finally gets a sense of the ridiculous and decide that these are so widespread on the planet. This is a reality that possibly the French Broadcasting Authority might eventually cotton on to.
Interestingly, French President Nicolas Sarkozy just met with Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg at the G8 summit. It seems kind of odd that the French president would meet with the, you know, the poster boy for social media, and at the same time this ruling comes out.
It's going to be interesting to see how he reacts. He's got spin doctors and advisors, and his website for his 2007 campaign was certainly the best website. It had a live feed, it had television, it had all sorts of things, and for 4 years ago it was really an achievement. So it's going to be interesting to watch whether suddenly somebody at the Élysée realizes that they look ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, exactly what happens when Nicolas Sarkozy runs for president next time and he says, follow my Facebook page. I mean, would that be illegal?
point? What do you do if it's not somebody working for the channel? Will they bleep it? I don't know.
Right. He's not a broadcaster, but the broadcasters who would record that would have to give that consideration, I guess.
The broadcasters would have to say something like, the president advised his audience to follow his social media feed.
Not exactly catchy, eh? That's journalist Anne Elizabeth Moutet and The Big Show's Marco Werman. Coming up, we have everything you always wanted to know about the word Canuck. But before that, I've got one of those conversations that first aired on The Big Show in a much shorter form. I've recut the interview, reinstated a bunch of material related to language that we didn't have room for in the original broadcast version. I'm going to let Lisa Mullins introduce this guy, but I should say that his essays were some of the first that I read before I went to Japan for the first time. And listen out too for a nice eating sideways expression, motanai. That's all I'll say. So, over to Lisa.
Donald Keene has taught his final class at Columbia University. He has taught there for, Professor Keene, I want to make sure I have this right, is it 56 years?
That's correct.
56 years. This is big news, not just on campus, but also in Japan. Dozens of Japanese journalists and TV crews crowded into Professor Keene's classroom to send back reports of that last lecture. Professor Keene has written dozens of books about Japanese culture, and they've earned him the highest respect. Now Donald Keene is even more popular in Japan because he's decided to spend the rest of his life there. Professor Keene, you are still in New York right now, but I know you're headed for Japan this summertime. How did you first get to know Japanese culture?
I first began to become interested in it in 1940 when I was 18 years old. It was a very, very gloomy time. It was a time when the Nazi armies were running over Norway, Denmark, Holland, Belgium, France, and then the Battle of Britain began. And I couldn't bear to look at the newspapers. One day I went into a secondhand bookshop and I saw two volumes called The Tale of Genji, the most important work of Japanese literature. I'd never heard of this book before, but it was so cheap for two volumes that I bought it. And I started to read it in the marvelous translation by Arthur Whaley. And that made me a captive of Japanese literature for the rest of my life.
So at this point, you were basically trying to escape the news of the day. You became really engaged in Japanese culture. You started learning the language, in fact. And then came Pearl Harbor.
Yes. When the war began, I heard a radio broadcast saying there were only 50 people in the United States who could read Japanese. This was completely untrue. There were hundreds of thousands of Japanese Americans, but I didn't know about them. And I thought, maybe I'm one of the 50. I investigated and discovered that the Navy had a Japanese language school, and I applied to it, and eventually I was accepted. I studied Japanese intensively for 11 months, and then was sent out to the Pacific. I spent altogether 4 years in the Navy, and I think almost every day of it, I had some reason to look at a Japanese book or to talk Japanese.
And your skills were very valuable during the war itself. You became an intelligence officer. What was your job?
I had two jobs. The main part was reading captured Japanese documents, documents picked up on the battlefield or occasionally plucked out of the water, and trying to find material in these documents that would be helpful in knowing about the next place we were going to attack and so on. The other part of my work was interrogating Japanese prisoners. This was far more interesting. In fact, I made friends of these people. I didn't think of them as enemies, and some of them have kept up the friendship even after the war ended and when I first went to Japan.
Because you knew Japanese culture so well, there was something else that you observed when you were talking to these prisoners of war, and that was the fact that they were shamed at the very fact that they were held prisoner.
Yes, they were told very strictly that they must not become prisoners in any circumstances. For this reason, they were never told what to do if they became prisoners. And the result of this was, ironically, that they talked far more than if they'd been told not to. They were dead as far as they were concerned, and they could not return to Japan because their families would not recognize them. They would be ashamed to be seen.
Did you feel any kind of sympathy for them at that point?
Yes, enormously.
Then did you try to assuage their feelings at all? I mean, after all, they were prisoners, but clearly you had some feelings toward them.
Yes, I did. I asked them to consider that they should be among those who are rebuilding New Japan after the war ended.
My guess is that this is probably unlike most interrogations that they had with American forces.
I think so. It was partly because I had no hatred of the Japanese at any point. My teachers were all Japanese. I liked them very much. And the prisoners, on the whole, were very likable people. And once I finished the routine questions, I'd ask them, what books have you been reading lately? Or what is your favorite kind of music? And things like that. Obviously not of any tactical value. I became involved in these people, and I wanted to save them.
You know, I have a question about that, because as a veteran, I'm sure that you've known many other World War II veterans from the Pacific Theater who would not, in subsequent years after the war, buy Japanese cars, or, you know, they might shudder when they hear the Japanese language. One of them, in fact, told me, it was a Marine who said that he had this kind of revulsion because he was trained as a young Marine to hate the Japanese, and that's the only way he could fight the war. Did you ever feel that way, any kind of revulsion yourself, or maybe that was kind of a parting factor between you and other vets?
I felt no hatred for the Japanese at any point. I did feel dismay when I learned of Americans who had been killed by Japanese gunfire, whatever it was. But I didn't feel hatred for any of the people. And it was not only myself. I was not such an exception. I think all of us who had spent time learning the Japanese language, learning about the culture, felt a basic sympathy, not for the kind of government that the Japanese had, nor for the militarists, certainly not, but for the individual Japanese who in many cases had been deceived into thinking that it was the fault of the Allies that the war started, not the fault of Japan.
Is there something in the Japanese language itself that you took to beyond, I don't know how many other languages that you know, but what really intrigued you about it?
I felt very warmly attracted to it. I did study other languages. I loved French, for one, but I hated Latin. I could never remember German. But with Japanese, it was no effort. Other people who were struggling over the characters that use in Japanese and cursing them for all their peculiarities, I enjoyed the peculiarities. I enjoyed having to deal with characters in many, many strokes, which made them seem more and more captivating, mysterious. I felt that I was definitely made to learn Japanese.
And is there something that you would ask these prisoners in the Japanese language that maybe would be difficult to translate into English, but you knew the Japanese way to ask it?
There are certain Japanese expressions, which it's not impossible to say in English, but it's roundabout, whereas the Japanese expression goes right to the heart of the matter. And the fact that I could say these words may have made Japanese prisoners feel more at ease with me than if I had stuck to the words found in a dictionary.
Any chance you can recall an example?
I can think of one. Mottai nai. Mottai nai has very many meanings, but it means essentially it's too good for me. I didn't expect anything so good to happen, and I'm really worthy of it. It's been something like that.
And did you have a lot of occasion to use that?
No, just once in a while.
Well, your own interest in the Japanese people and culture and affinity for the language is going to be taking you to Japan, because I guess you're going to be retiring there. You're going to be moving there this summertime. And do you mind if I ask you how old you are?
I'm 88, but I'll be very soon 89.
And I guess 88 is, as you said in your last lecture at Columbia University, a very important number in Japanese culture.
It is. The Japanese have a feeling about certain numbers, especially numbers like 88 or 77 or 55, but 88 especially, because it's not only interesting as a number, but people normally didn't live that long. In the past, almost nobody lived to be 88. And so it was the occasion for celebration of someone who had reached the magic number of 88.
You know, it's I can understand in that respect why you're going. For a lot of people, it might be hard to understand why an American would move there, not only at age 88, almost 89, but also because of everybody that's been affected there by the earthquake and tsunami. Not the entirety of Japan, but certainly it's had great effect in the area where the disasters were.
Yes. I had thought seriously of going to Japan and living the rest of my life there. But this feeling became very strong after the disasters, particularly when I read of Western people leaving Japan in hordes to be away from the danger. I thought this was intolerable, and I thought if only one person went in the opposite direction, it might be worthwhile. And it has proved to be so in the fact that I have received many letters from Japanese, all of them expressing happiness that I had made this decision.
Well, Professor Keene, I wish you the best in Japan as you move there this summertime after, as we said, teaching at Columbia University for 56 years. American World War II veteran Donald Keene, very nice to meet you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, now hockey news. Well, sort of. As we do here on the pod, we cover sports, but in sort of a, you know, nerdy lingo cultural way. Not that I don't like sports myself. I do, though I may draw the line at hockey or ice hockey, as people outside North America call it. I did once go to an NHL game. It had its moments, but meh, I don't think I'll go back. Now, if like me, you are shrugging at all this hockey excitement, you're missing out on a little linguistic matter. The Stanley Cup Final Series, the best of seven, is between the Boston Bruins and the Vancouver Canucks. Yes, Canucks. Canucks! Isn't Canuck a derogatory term? Well, my friend and Big Show colleague, Andrea Crossan, says no. And she should know. Here's why.
I'll say it. I'm a Canuck, born and raised in Vancouver, Canada. Canuck is a slang word for a Canadian. The term was first used in lumber camps in Maine. It referred to French Canadians. Later, it came to mean all Canadians. And yes, I know, you Yanks sometimes say it as an insult. But north of the border, it's a different story.
It might have started out as a derogatory term, but I think it's something we've claimed back as Canadians because everyone wears the Canuck label with pride, especially in Vancouver and BC.
That's Scott Brown. He's the sports editor of the Vancouver Sun newspaper.
Most people in Canada know Canuck as a slang for Canadians, and they also know of Johnny Canuck, who was a comic book character.
The comic book hero Johnny Canuck dates back to the 1800s. He was depicted as a wholesome young man dressed as a logger. Johnny used to represent Canada just as Uncle Sam represents the U.S. And Johnny Canuck still has some fans. The image has been revitalized in recent years on Canuck's hockey jerseys. And if you look very closely, you'll see Johnny Canuck on the ice tomorrow night.
Oh, what a save by Luongo!
Vancouver Canucks goalie Roberto Luongo has the comic book hero painted on his mask.
Ever since I got here, I'm a big fan of the Johnny Canuck, so I just decided to go with that and try to make a little bit of intimidation there with this face. So it came up pretty nice.
So Johnny Canuck lives on. And as for being a Canuck, sports editor Scott Brown says you don't have to be born in Canada to be one.
Right now, we're accepting all members throughout the world to be Canucks. We're actually running a feature in the paper called Canucks All Over the World, and we've talked to people who claim to be Canucks in Nigeria, who claim to be Canucks in Hong Kong. In Europe, we have a friend who's works for a Slovakian radio station over there who's claiming to be a Canuck. So it's non-exclusive membership being a Canuck.
Maybe no exclusive membership to be a Canuck, but there is an exclusive club the Vancouver Canucks hockey team would like to join. They're hoping this is the year they hoist the Stanley Cup over their heads for the first time in the team's 41-year history. For the world, I'm Andrea Crossan. Go Canucks!
Hello out there, we're on the air, it's hockey night tonight. Tension grows, the whistle blows, and the puck goes down the ice. The goalie jumps and the players bump and the fans all go insane. Someone roars, Bobby scores at the good old hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game. Second period.
I have to ask this question at this very point in the podcast. Is there such a thing as a good sports song? I think not. Mind you, I'm a big fan of cheesy, and, well, this one is pretty stinky. So I'll just let it play.
It's a 1-1 hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game.
Okay, one other thing I have to say. Not because I care an awful lot, but, well, I just heard Andrea say it, and it sounded like an awful lot of fun to say. So I'll say it too. Go Canucks! I'll see you on Facebook, Twitter, anywhere else I'll pass across. More next week.
Hockey players face off down the rink, and the Stanley Cup is all filled up for the champs who win the drink. Now the final flick of a hockey stick and a one gigantic scream. The puck is in, the home team wins the good old hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game.